Thank you. This is listed as a Blackboard talk, and I am going to primarily use Blackboard. But thank Ilya Grisberg. I have a couple of pictures we'll put up here. The physics motivation problems, where this has come from, is basically critical phenomenon in two dimensions. So this is an example of a simulation from the easing model. So we have black and white squares, but you can think of the black squares as being arrows pointed up, and white squares as arrows pointed down. And that's clearly not a completely random configuration. And in fact, that configuration is chosen with a particular weight. So the weight for a particular configuration is given by, when we look at the number of disagreeing neighbors. So the number of instances where you have a white and black together. And then we have a parameter beta, and the weighting is e to the minus beta times that. So it prefers to have agreeing neighbors with each other. Now, there's a parameter beta here, which is inversely proportional to temperature. So high temperature means small beta, low temperature means high beta. And there's a particular value of beta for this picture. If beta were very small and high temperature, then this interaction wouldn't have much of an effect, and this picture would be just sort of blacks and whites interspersed with each other. If beta were very large, low temperature, then there would be very, very strong favor to have almost no disagreement, white, black. And in fact, there's a sharp transition between this sort of very random phase to this very structured phase. And this beta is chosen to be the critical value. So the critical beta, or criticality. So this critical behavior phenomenon that we actually get these sort of pretty pictures. Now this isn't that big a simulation, so you don't see a scaling yet, but as you see that the interfaces between whites and black, we have big black clusters, big white clusters, and there's also randomness in there. And these interfaces are sort of curves that in sort of the limit are going to have some sort of fractal structure. And this is the kind of thing we're going to be talking about. In order so that we don't have so many curves, what one often does is try to focus on one curve, one interface curve. And one way to have one interface curve is to put some boundary conditions. I have a picture here, but I can also look at this picture in a different way. I can imagine I have a bounded domain. And on the boundary here, I put all plus spins up. And on the boundary here, I put all minus spins. And then on the inside, I use this rule. So here, so we have all the minus spins there, all the plus spins there. And then what happens is an interface develops between the pluses and minuses. So there's got to be an interface here where it's plus spins on this side of that line and minus spins on the opposite side. And the question is, what does this interface look like large? As, say, the lattice gets very fine, or for a very large lattice. Now, if you look at this picture, if I sort of focus on this curve alone, well, there's a certain weight associated to that curve, because that curve is full of disagreeing neighbors. So there's a certain weight to that, which is basically, in some sense, e to the minus beta times the length of that curve. But then there's also a whole bunch of stuff there which makes it hard exactly to see what's going to happen. That's the easing model. There are other models. Now, this isn't that much of a picture here. But there's a curve there. And that's actually not taken from the easing model, but something else called the self-avoiding walk. And this is an example where the only interaction, the only weight you put on the curve is something like this, e to the minus beta times the, well, number of disagreeing neighbors, times the length. So the weight of a curve only depends on the length, or sort of all curves of the same length have the same weight. All curves non-intersecting of same length have the same weight. And this model exists for a long, has been around for a long time. This is actually a model for polymers in a dilute solution. So this is an old model for polymers, where basically polymers are randomly put together with the only restriction that they can't have intersections. Let me put a third model up while I still have this thing here. There's no time there. Yeah, it's sort of some sense it's, yeah, the only thing resembling time is length. In other words,
are these polymers in the solvent surrounded by molecules that are hitting them all the time randomly?
We really idealized it. So the only interaction, so the molecule is only interacting with itself. So this is sort of very, very, very dilute. There is a way to tell the top from the bottom. Okay. So this next model is an example of percolation. So what I've drawn here, or what I've put up here, I didn't draw it, is a cluster on the triangular lattice, where the points of the triangular lattice are represented by hexagons. And except for the bottom, all the hexagons have been randomly colored white or black, each with probability a half. So the blacks and whites are equally likely. And in fact, we could have chosen a different probability for blacks and whites, but we've actually chosen this probability because it's the one which has criticality phenomenon. In this case, in particular, if I sort of ignore the bottom for the thing and ask whether or not there's a crossing of connected blacks and whites, it's some number strictly between 0 and 1. I mean, sorry, well, the thickly one, that, I mean, that is crossing enough. The probability is between 0 and 1. And what we've done here is we have an interface between black and white. So the bottom is our boundary condition, very much like this boundary condition over here. We put all blacks here, all whites there, and now we've developed an interface between the blacks and whites. And this curve has the same sort of, well, it's not the same sort of properties, but it's another example of a fractal curve at criticality. Let me just put in another picture, which is a finer thing, where, no, this is the way it goes. Where here we have white and black initial conditions, and here we have this sort of curve that's going off like that. So this is an example of a percolation cluster. And now I think I'm going to make use of the entire board. These were the motivations plus one more model, which I'm going to mention right now, but I don't have a picture for. Actually, I'm going to mention two more models that I don't have pictures for. So that's model 1, 2, 3, And yes, these were motivations as well, for sure. But the next two are going to look a little more mathematical. Fourth actually goes back to Benoit Mandelbrot's book, Fractal Geometry of Nature, where he looked at just a two-dimensional Brownian motion. So I'll just make a picture. Not a very good picture, but there's a picture of a Brownian motion. He actually took a Brownian loop where he assumed that the Brownian motion began and ended at the same point. He actually did a random walk, of course, discrete version of this. And what he looked at was the outer boundary. Actually, the way he phrased it is he actually filled it in to make a Brownian island, I think he called it in the book, and then looked at the coastline of the island. So it's this curve on the outside. And
does that include in the interior?
It did not include the interior. So in other words, you take this blob, which is really rough, fill in the entire inside, and then you just sort of look at the coastline you have left, which is really turned out to be a fractal. It's not a very good picture there. It generally isn't. And in fact, if you look at the inside, you look at all the, there's actually lots of different components, all of which have the same kind of behavior as this. But this is, in the same way for the easing model, we had lots of clusters, we focus on one interface. This is another way to focus on one interface. Yeah, so. What he noticed in looking at this was that the simulations were very much like the simulations for self-avoiding walks. Now let me tell you, for self-avoiding walks, back about around 1950, actually a little earlier than that, Flory made a prediction which translated into language I want to use it, can think of it this way, that the fractal dimension of self-avoiding walks is 4/3. Now for a fractal, there's lots of definitions of fractal dimension. For the purposes of today's talk, there's a very simple one we can use. Suppose the lattice spacing is 1 over n. So we have an n by n grid. Then the length of the interface, the number of steps in the interface, when I say length, I mean the number of steps, looks like n to the fractal dimension. I mean just the number of steps in the interface. And what Mandelbrot noticed was that this seemed to have the same behavior, appeared to be fractal dimension. Four thirds. And so he made this conjecture, and in fact, even went bolder than that and suggested that maybe this was a model of self-avoiding walks, was to do this rather unusual idea of taking a Brownian motion, filling it in, and doing, go like that. I'll give one other model. Loop erase random walk. Now let me just sort of give you an idea how this goes. Let's just take our domain again. And suppose we take just a random walk, just a normal random walk where we allow ourselves to retrace our steps. Take a random walk staying in D, staying in our domain. So D is just an everything. Take a random walk in D, connecting the points.
Bound up the wall?
In this case, we'll actually just restrict to those that stay in. So in a statistical mechanical model, just look at all paths that stay in this. Look at all the ones that stay in. And then this has many, many self-intersections. Just in order, erase the loops. So erase the loops, and that will give you something. A subpath. By erasing loops. Now, it may not appear, this may be a very ad hoc definition, in many ways it is, but it's actually, this particular process arises in a number of things. For instance, if I put down a lattice here and I took a spanning tree at random from the set of all spanning trees and asked, what's the connection in the spanning tree from there to there, its statistics would be just given by this process. So there's lots of ways this comes in. Okay, so now we have lots of different, well, so we have percolation. Now its interface was a little more ragged than this. And the question is, what's the mathematics that ties all these things together? So how can we describe the large-scale behavior? Or instead of thinking large-scale, I can shrink it down and I can think of continuum limits. Instead of thinking large scale, I can take a smaller and smaller lattice and try to get to the limit. Well, okay. I should say there are many different quantities one's interested in all of these models and many other models, lots of critical exponents. I'm not going to discuss the critical exponents except for basically one property. One exponent that comes in is perhaps the dimension of the path, and I think I'll focus on this one. And in different cases, we might get different dimensions. Okay. Now, in trying to answer these questions, mathematicians like me in the 80s were particularly unsuccessful. And the physics community was making the most progress, although not from a mathematically rigorous perspective. Three names that should be put up, and I can never remember how to spell them. In the late 70s, early 80s, were the first ones to really give from, let's say, a prediction that, in a sense, these critical models, two-dimensional, in the limit, exhibit some kind of conformal invariance. I'm not going to be precise about what they meant about conformal invariance, and in fact, I never could figure out exactly what some of these things, exactly what they meant. However, it was clear from this, and also people worked on in the 80s, Nienhuyst, Pontier, Sayer, Cardi, there's lots of other names I can, that the techniques of non-rigorous conformal field theory I'm used to talking to mathematicians. And if you tell a mathematician something, there's also, I should say non-rigorous arguments using. Okay, let me be a little more non-mathematically rigorous arguments using conformal field theory. Actually, it's actually not the conformal field theory itself that was non-rigorous. It was the relationship to the problems and things like, okay. I'm sorry about that. And in fact, instead of the mysterious what the relationship was, but from conformal field theory, there are a number of predictions about exponents. By the way, talking about language, prediction is the compromise word that mathematicians and a lot of physicists have agreed on. Mathematicians use the word conjecture, but that's too weak. So the word prediction means something that's not mathematically rigorous, but has lots of theoretical argument behind it. So that, when I say prediction, that's what I mean.
And most often true.
And most often true.
There's not actually an obvious example in this field prediction for what we things we know are true.
To be honest on this, by the way, I understand the physics community works often, is that people write papers, there's lots of things that are not true. But they don't get replicated and they don't continue. So the things that actually survive many times tend out to be true. which is back to that. That's a more.
Sure, if you define the physics literature as anything, then by that physics, somebody says it's content. You know, that goes all the way to things which are.
Right. Okay.
So, but we know what we mean. I mean, there are examples in some areas of physics where physicists do make loose statements that are not true, and mathematical rigor actually identifies it. But, you know, conformal field theory and some parts of the common field theory have quite, by now, a long history of making true statements which can't.
Okay. In this particular case, I don't know of, I mean, I do know of cases where the answer was correct and precise, but they couldn't determine what the question was. So let me say what conformal field theory didn't give to these problems. Okay, conformal field theory produced numbers, lots of numbers, including numbers such as this. Mere mortals, i.e. mathematicians, like me, couldn't quite understand how they're gotten. I mean, at some point it reduces, you get to an algebraic problem, then the algebraic representation theory, okay, then that part's okay, but how you get from these nice little measure on paths to there was a mystery. It also did not produce a description of this interface. So there was, it did not describe the interface. Even from a mathematically non-rigorous perspective. And there was no construction of a continuum limit except in terms of, you would have correlation functions for fields that you could compute or something like that, but exactly what the limiting field was. No.
Right,
Except in a few soluble cases. Even then, though, the continuum limit wasn't constructed. Rigorous limits of lattice systems were computed, I would say. So, yeah, that's being I'm being a mathematician. I'm sorry. So, what are the continuum limits? What are the possible continuum limits? Now we're going to be much more a mathematician. From a mathematician perspective, what we're going to do is say, what are the assumptions that we expect the limit to satisfy, and does this characterize? So we put down assumptions to be satisfied by the limit. And then ask the question, do these determine the limit? At this point, we'll skip ahead to a paper by Oded Schramm. And Oded Schramm was particularly, had the loop race walk particularly in his motivations, although afterwards he also pulled in the percolation, so these were the two models he was looking at. But the assumptions that he wrote down actually could hold for any of the models except for the Brownian frontier, the outer boundary of Brownian motion. So let's look at the assumptions. So these are possible interfaces. So an interface would be a measure, say a probability measure, on curves between two points on a domain D. Say I make that Z and make that W, I'll just use gamma to call the curve. Yeah, and this is a domain, use capital D for a domain. And one of the assumptions, which goes back to the work, the physics literature, is we assume conformal invariance. Now, that was a big assumption for some of the models, but actually, in this particular model, it actually was not much of an assumption. In fact, it was very natural to assume, because, in fact, we already knew in probability, say going back to Levy, that Brownian motion is conformally invariant. In two dimensions. So if I didn't go through the procedure of erasing loops, I actually knew that was conformally invariant. And in fact, erasing loops is something done chronologically, which shouldn't be changed by conformal transformation. That's not a proof because the continuous level of loop erasing is a bit subtle, but there's good reasons to believe this. And then the other property that he noticed that the satisfied was actually a Markov property, but the combination goes into a conformal Markov property. So let me do this by picture. Suppose I've seen a certain amount of the curve, and I want to know the probability distribution of the rest of the curve given what I have so far. So that's what I have so far. And let's assume we're in a simply connected domain D. The reason why a simply connected domain is nice is because if I take a slit from a simply connected domain, it's still simply connected. And the Riemann mapping theorem says that I can map this back to the original domain. So let me take this slit and map this back to the original domain. That's not a very good picture, I know. So that point has become that point. And then this would be here. And the assumption is that this distribution, the distribution for this, is exactly the same as the original distribution. Actually, I say this, yeah, I mean, this is the assumption Fromm made, that actually at this point, I knew that at that time as well. What Oded Fromm knew was some complex variables that I didn't know. So what did Oded Fromm do? Well, he decided to move to a convenient domain, which would be the upper half plane. So D will be the upper half plane. We'll have the same picture. And we'll map back to the upper half plane. Call this map G sub T. There's a point. Now, in general, in the examples we've been doing, if we think of this as being an interface, this is going to be a fractal curve. So we're trying to give a random dynamics for a fractal curve, and that's not so easy to do if you try to give it in terms of derivative. Well, the nice thing that people from complex variables did, instead of trying to look at the curve, they looked off of the curve. And what they actually looked at was the map G sub T. And it goes back really to ideas of Charles Lerner, or at least a version of this. We're looking at doing work on the Bieber-Bach conjecture a long time ago. To say that in a picture like this, one can actually write down the differential equation for G sub T, at least what it looks like, how it moves if I'm off the curve. And I'll just write down the equation because it's actually very easy. There is a little subtlety in this that I won't go into, and that is I have to parameterize this curve appropriately. But naturally, it's not clear how to parameterize this. These interfaces, I mean, in some sense, we are doing something very unnatural. Let's remember what our picture is coming from. In our examples, this is an interface, say, an easing interface, or even a polymer, which really doesn't evolve over time. This curve doesn't evolve over time. It comes down into equilibrium. But yet what we're doing is we're pretending as if it is evolving with time, and like that. Given that it doesn't really evolve with time, we might as well choose time however we wish it, and we choose an appropriate parameterization. So, and this u sub t is just, I'm just defining it by picture. So this picture is just differential equations. There's nothing in this picture using the distribution at all. But what Oded Fromm said was, well, if I make this sort of conformal Markov property assumption, that tells me something about this u sub t. It's got to be a continuous function, a random continuous function, and in fact, it's got to satisfy certain independent increment properties. So the conformal Markov property and the conformal invariance in general implies that u sub t is a one-dimensional Brownian motion. Without drift, mean zero, expected, so. So in fact, there's only one parameter one could deal with, and that's the speed of the Brownian motion. So B sub t will be a speed one Brownian motion, and then we can put a constant, which is generally called square root of kappa, time for this. So in fact, that's all that it can be. So Bertrand, assuming the conformal Markov property, then it has to satisfy this with this. And so what then he did was defined the solution of this with this input to be, well, he called it the stochastic Lerner evolution. And that terminology seems to be holding up in the physics literature and in the papers of which Schramm is a co-author. But in the math literature in which Schramm is not a co-author, the term Schramm-Lerner evolution is used. Either way, the acronym is SLE. Now, it's not so obvious that if I stick in a Brownian motion there, I will actually get a curve. And in fact, that's technically difficult, and Oded Schramm, with Stefan Rota, wrote a very important paper showing that the curve exists in all cases. However, the sort of amazing thing is that the qualitative features of the curve vary greatly as kappa changes. Now, if there's anyone out there who hasn't seen this and can actually look at that equation and figure out what happens for different kappas, you've got way too much intuition for me. So just, if you've never seen this before, I mean, you can't have a feel for what this really does.
What about this? Yeah, why a single pole?
That's basically the assumption that we're growing at a single point. That's sort of one of our assumptions, is that our curve is, we're just growing at a point and no more than that. That's.
So even if you have a double pole at the same point, that
would be you. Why is it at the same point? This function, okay, if you look at the derivation of this equation, this is basically the Poisson kernel in the upper half plane. It's a particular function. It's a complex form of the Poisson kernel. If you just see how it evolves over time, it just is this. So my explanation as to why that's true would really have to be a derivation of this equation, which I don't really want to do.
Right? Maybe if you just put u equal to zero, forget about u and solve the equation, and you will see that it just describes a little slit growing in the upper half plane, a straight line.
That's true. By the way, that's sometimes called SLE zero. SLE kappa, that's putting kappa equals zero into this equation. So what does this curve look like?
We just demonstrated it. Since kappa equals zero, it's called everything.
I haven't seen any other kappas yet. Okay. For kappa less than or equal to 4, and I guess even including 0, then the curve is a simple, and by simple here I mean non-self-intersecting, curve. except for cap equals zero, it's going to be fractal. Before less than kappa less than 8, let me draw a picture. It happens on all scales, so it's hard to see, but it has self-intersections. But not self-crossings. So part of the equation sort of prevents, so anytime it sort of hits its path, it comes out. And so that doesn't quite fit this picture. So what happens in this picture for this g sub t, at any particular time when I remove this curve, g sub t is actually the map of the unbounded component onto h. It's not. It can't map the insides as well. But and for kappa greater than or equal to 8, it's actually plane filling. It goes to every point, which makes it hard to draw. Well, it doesn't really, you know, it sort of doesn't. Well, I'm not going to try. Okay, two-dimensional boundary motion is not in this picture. When all of these curves never go to the inside, they always stay on the outside, while two-dimensional boundary motion would go on the inside. Now, I'll talk about the boundary motion in a little bit. Okay. But I do want to say here, the fractal dimension of the image is 1 plus kappa over 8. So as kappa increases, the path gets rougher and rougher until it gets to 8, in which case at that point becomes 2. And so basically, if we assume the formal Markov property, all the interfaces must be in here. So interfaces must be an SLE kappa. But of course, you might ask the question, which kappa? So there's a one-parameter family parameterizing these things. Well, the mathematicians were not the first to find that they're naturally one-parameter family parameterizing these things. In fact, in conformal field theory,
that's a question. But that's assuming that the fractal dimension turns uniquely
the. No, what I'm saying is that if you have an interface whose limit satisfies the conformal Markov property, it's got to be one of these things. And as it also turns out, if you happen to know the fractal dimension, it's true that you would know which one. Well, I'm trying to think of it the other way, which is trying to determine the fractal dimension rather than. Yeah. In conformal field theory, these two-dimensional things were parameterized by something for central charge, generally used C, and we now know that there's a relationship between C and kappa.
That actually, you're answering the question, since you're
okay.
Precise in your technique, you know that it's going to have a conformal Markov property, and you know that it's not the dimension. Are you saying that it has to be a unique probability?
Yes, because, I mean, under the assumption of conformal Markov property as stated, it's an SLE kappa. And if your fractal dimension is strictly less than 2, there's only one SLE kappa with that fractal dimension.
For example, you can imagine interfaces when you have several degrees of freedom that could carry even quantum numbers. I mean, these are not just the six, right?
No. Okay. This is sort of the first start toward lots of things. Even forgetting the quantum numbers, the exact conformal Markov property is a very strong property, that only certain exact interfaces, like the easing interface with a particular set of boundary conditions, will satisfy. So I mean, you have to be very particular about what kind of thing will satisfy these things. Yeah. But we're mathematicians. We like to be precise. Okay, so so this is the relationship. This is actually a 2-to-1 relationship. For each C, there are two values of kappa. Well, actually, for every C less than 1, there's two values of kappa. And for C equals 1, there's one value of kappa. And they're related by kappa times kappa prime equals 16. So in order to determine system, you need to know what kappa it is. And now, let me just go back through some of our models. Let me start with the self-avoiding walk. Now, I don't want to assume Flory's conjecture or anything like that. Let's just assume the conformal Markov property. And I want to tell you another property that the self-avoiding walk satisfies. So now I've got sort of the uniform measure on paths connecting two points. Suppose I make my domain smaller. So let D prime be a perturbation of D. And let's look at our measure. Then we have a measure on paths which is the conditional measure assuming gamma lies in D prime. So what I'm saying here is I have a probability measure on curves in D. I've got a smaller domain D prime, and I can say, well, let's just look at the conditional probability that the curve lies in D prime given it lies in D. That's well defined. That's a probability measure on curves. But assuming that D prime is simply connected, there's another probability measure on curves in D prime, which is what I get from conformal invariance from D. So another thing I could do is just conformally map D to D prime. Now, the definition of the self-avoiding walk, which has to do with just uniform measure on paths, would have the property that these two things, that the measure on D prime would be this. Just by the lattice definition, you can see this, that the self-avoiding walk has this property. But we're also assuming it's a conformally invariant limit, so we're assuming this. So the self-avoiding walk should be a measure on simple paths. So it should be a measure on simple paths, and it should satisfy this property, the fact that these two are the same. And the fact that those two are the same is sometimes called the restriction property. And the conformal Markov property and the restriction property, in fact, do determine it. If you had a measure having on this, kappa would have to be 8/3. That's a mathematical theorem. So the only possible limit for self-avoiding walks is kappa equals 8/3, which over here, if you get it, it also gives dimension equals 4/3. This actually gives lots of information. So in fact, we now have a very good conjecture of what the limit of self-avoiding walks are. And in fact, Tom Kennedy has done simulations on self-avoiding walks which show that this SLE 8/3 just has to be right. No one knows how to prove it. So in this case, for the self-avoiding walk, there's no proof. There's no proof. There's a continuous theorem which says that if you have something satisfying like a formal Markov property on simple curves, you're satisfied the restriction property, then it's SLE 8/3. That's a theorem. If the self-avoiding walk has a conformally invariant limit, that limit satisfies the restriction property. That's easy. Self-avoiding walk having a conformally invariant limit is not been proved. It's proving the continuum. Well, it's proving anything about the set. There's no proving anything about lattice self-avoiding walks. There's almost nothing non-trivial about two-dimensional self-avoiding lattice self-avoiding walks that's been proved.
I thought you said that you walk.
Self-avoiding walks. Let me just. Yes. Now, in order to answer that question, I have to know what intuition you have for C equals zero. But one of the intuitions of C equals zero. Just to answer that somewhat, one of my intuitions for C equals zero is what happens when you perturb a domain, and it doesn't affect. The fact that perturbation of the domain doesn't affect the intrinsic curve is a C equals zero. Another C equals zero thing, by the way, is percolation. Percolation is also something that satisfies a very locality property. If I'm looking at my blacks and whites here and I perturb the domain there, it doesn't affect the distribution here at all. But the percolation, you may note, did not look like the self-avoiding walk. In fact, the percolation domain interface is cap equals 6, which is the other value which goes with C equals 0. And in the case of the triangular lattice, the one that I gave above before, this is a theorem. And there's a number of aspects to this theorem, but the most important part in terms of getting the lattice to the continuous level was done by Stas-Smirnov, who will be visiting us later this week, I think. So there's some other bit, but that's... So in the case of percolation, we actually know the limit is cap equals 6. Now, for percolation, in fact, something nice happens. If I look at the percolation cluster, or just this interface, let me just draw it like that. The dimension of this curve is 7/4, which you get if you put cap equals 6 in there. But you could also ask the same question about this outer boundary of this. And the outer boundary of percolation has dimension 4/3. And for SLE, that's a theorem. And in fact, there's another object which has this, which is also a theorem, and that's back to the Brownian motion. For the Brownian motion, if I look at the outer boundary of that, it is a theorem. Now that dimension is 4/3. And it not only is it 4/3, but in fact, this outer boundary and this outer boundary both locally have the same thing. Behavior as the SLE 8/3. No, because the Brownian motion curve itself is actually, that's a bad picture, but a Brownian motion is a two-dimensional curve. Yes, no. Yeah. However, okay, but the proof of this theorem was probably the first major theorem proved using SLE. And there was a way to relate SLE estimates to these estimates, but I don't have time to do that today. So that was proved using SLE, but it's not an SLE. Let me do the loop race walk. So this should be an SLE. Now I brought this little restriction property in here. This restriction property said sort of the if it's self-avoiding walk on the lattice scale, the measure of this path was just e to the minus beta number of steps. It didn't really care about where it lived. For the loop race walk, the measure of a path has to do with how many simple walks, how many regular usual random walks produce this among loop racing. If I change my domain here, that affects the number of walks that will produce this. Moving this will actually fit the domain. This does not satisfy restriction. And so, in fact, cap equals 8/3 is not a good candidate for this. There are other things one can compute for this. I'll just tell you that this is cap equals 2. C equals minus 2, if you like that for your scorecard. And this is a theorem. I'll end with easing model. Oh, cap equals 8 is the loop race walk is a very uniform spanning tree. Take the uniform spanning tree and you take the path that sort of there's a path that gives that's cap equals 8, and that's also a theorem. By the way, the C's for these, so C equals 0 here, C equals 0 here, C equals minus 2 here. The physics was well known by the informal field theory, as well as the easing model. Which is C equals 1/2. And in this case, kappa is equal to 3. And if you plug into the dimension, fractal dimension, is 11/8. And probably a good place for me to stop today is where you have to ask the question, is this one a theorem or not? Your answer is, ask Stas when he gets into town.
Why is it not pi?
Why?
Why is it not pi? 3.1516 blah, blah, blah. The dimension.
If you believe this I had that theorem for, if it is SLE kappa with kappa equals 3, then the dimension is this. And there are if you believe those numbers, you have to get those numbers somehow. I'm not giving you any argument for those numbers, but they are. Actually, Stas has. He's been working a lot of it, but he has actually claimed, he has not written it up yet, but I do believe Stas-Smirnov has proved this very recently in the case of the triangular lattice. Okay, but I think my hour is up, so I think I'll stop there.
For C equals 0, we know there's only one positive theory, of course, which is sort of trivial. I presume the types of theories you have in mind here should be non-positive theories, is that right?
Yeah, I mean...
Do we know which theories they are?
I mean, these are... Okay. Everything here, okay, I phrased everything in terms of the interfaces, so I've actually phrased things in terms of geometric objects. So I actually haven't written down any fields, except for I guess I implicitly had one when I discussed the easing model.
There's another, I mean, you left out C equals 1.
I did, just because, yeah. Okay, for the yeah, for C equals 1, cap equals 4, there's work by, mainly by Schramm and Scott Sheffield, and they have two different models that actually go to cap equals 4. One is the contour lines of the free field. They have a way of getting it from the discrete free field, the lattice free field to the limit. They also have sort of a toy model, harmonic explorer, which reaches that. So yeah, so that's actually theorem for cap equals 4.
In physics, there's a famous C equals 1 barrier, which also occurs here.
Yes.
And in physics,
There are also some geometric ways that I didn't describe today where C equals bit 1 barrier comes up. For instance, another way to produce these interfaces or things like that are actually to take a soup of many Brownian motions. So just take Brownian loops, non-interacting, with certain densities, with exactly the right sort of densities so that things are conformally invariant. Okay, now it fills most of the plane for a given intensity, but there's some fractal pieces where it doesn't. So the fractal parts where it doesn't fill percolate up to a certain point, and the last point they percolate is the C equals 1 barrier. And beyond that, this particular model stops percolating. So, in some sense, this is really bad for C not equal to 1 because there's a C bigger than 1 because it's describing the interfaces for things that just probably don't exist for C bigger than 1. So there's no, it isn't even in here at all.
Is this just a numerical coincidence that the 4/3 in the Hausdorff dimension is the same as the 4/3 in the Kesey hierarchy at level 2?
I actually don't know. I'd have to look at that more carefully to find out. My guess is it's not a coincidence, but I'd have to check it. But see, deep down inside, you might find some reason for it. But I won't swear to that. Might be a bit stretched. Okay, so let me. I won't answer that question, but I'll answer a somewhat weaker question, which is that there is a lot of work going on right now which can be described as using this tool to construct conformal fields, having a way to build these things starting with the SLEs or multiple SLEs or loops of SLEs or things like that, and to get the conformal fields. Now, if you ask me, I don't know, I can't answer about string theory.
But we need superstring theory. I mean, quite seriously, this needs to be, on the conformal field theory side, amplified by the addition of these Grassmann variables. Because that's the one that's really
going. Well, there are two things. One is actually being done, right? From the mathematical perspective, to couple, put a measure on the underlying geometry as well.
That is being done.
That is being done. And that's what the same thing is doing. But that's not
There is a paper on supercomponent field theories.
So what is the curve from the
more or less reposition?
I'll ask if it's just algebraic, is it really SLE?
Well, but it's traced in terms of stochastic equations. It doesn't have geometric pictures, but stochastic equations. With the Grassmann derivative.
Is there a question over here?
Yeah, are there properties besides the fact of measuring the interface that are particularly using the answer this way?
The simple answer to that is yes, but that would be a lot of... Let me just say that there's lots of questions about the interface about that can be answered, and what happens is it reduces it to questions about stochastic differential equations, and or which then reduces just to second-order differential PDEs and things like this, or even ODEs. It is, like many other tools, it's sort of, there's a lot of things that can be answered and a lot of other things that don't answer very well.
Okay.
And some things is, so.
I mean, what kind of things can an answer reasonably well?
Can
an answer reasonably well? If
I take boundary conformal fields, most of the correlation functions for boundary conformal fields come out. I only put one interface in, but you can put in the bulk on the inside. It's a little; it's not quite as nice. I mean, yes. Okay. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's opening a whole nother subject, and one. I mean. The simple answer is, once you get outside of genus zero, there's not just one theory. There's only one parameter family of things you can put on genus zero things. Therefore, sort of, if you know kappa, if you know C, you know what you're talking about. If you allow yourself more complicated things, then you need a little more about specifics about what field you're talking about, what sort of problem you're talking about. There's not a unique way of generalizing into multiple domains. But the obvious reason is that the conformal Markov property gets thrown off. If you take a little piece of your curve and you map it back, you're now in a different conformally inequivalent domain. Right? Okay, let me... The tor, but actually slip tori is another you need. Yeah, it's modulus. If you put more holes in, it's more complicated and different sort of surface. It's all very. The simple answer is yes. People are very interested in these things, but it's not. It's not for the one-hour pedagogical talk.
So there's this class of conformal field theories which is particularly nicely behaved algebraically called the minimal model. Are you getting geometric analogs of the field? Are you familiar with them?
I am familiar with them, and I know enough to answer. I do not have an SLE description as to why the minimal models are nice.
Are all the models
discussed? Yes. Yeah. And that is true that almost all the nice ones, and there are, for each of the models for which one can actually take the limit, there's something nice happening on the lattice level description that allows the limit to be taken. It's different in each case, so if a self-avoiding walk, it hasn't been found yet. And there may be fundamental things going on there. But I
if the rumors are true, then Stas cannot disprove this for
O-N models
for any of them.
The last I told from Stas is that he has a program to prove that, but there are technical details that he can handle in the easing model case, but not right enough for the other cases. And it's again one of these, something happening on the discrete level that's doable. So he has a program, so a basic plan. But you can ask him when he gets in. I don't want to speak for him, but last I heard, he was only claiming it for the easing model. And that was about 2 weeks ago.
Okay, that's been great.